Oh, you can tell we're setting off on a journey, can't you? The story of humanity. It's the story of journeys. Our species has spread across the globe and now, well, we're mapping the cosmos. But could we ever make a journey to other stars? The distance, well, the distances are astronomical. And even with a ship designed for a voyage that lasts generations, the challenges are Herculean. These are some of the ideas in the novel Aurora. Kim Stanley Robinson is the author, and he's speaking here to Matthew Crawford.
Aurora is a novel about an attempt to take a multi-generational starship to one of the nearest stars to us, Tau Ceti, that has Earth-analog planets that might be inhabited by human beings.
Yes, and despite the fact that Tau Ceti is a star that's in our very immediate neighbourhood, it's by no means a small task to get there. How long does it take?
Well, if we were to accelerate a starship to one-tenth the speed of light, which is extraordinarily fast for anything human, it would still take about 200 years to get to Tau Ceti.
So it's an enormous undertaking, and what you've done is designed a very intricate fictional world around that very simple but very complicated concept that you've just outlined. And that intricate design is one of your hallmarks in your writing. And I just wonder, how did you go about building or setting up the world of Aurora?
Well, I went on the assumption that if there were to be any chance of success, it would have to be a kind of like a Noah's Ark that carried many, many genetic materials and essentially living things from Earth. And so they take along a biome, a small closed life supporting element from every one of the major ecospheres on Earth. So they have essentially 24 self-contained units where there's different environments ranging from tropical to Arctic and everything in between, so that when they get there, they might have a chance of introducing to this new and hopefully empty world that they arrive at all of the life of Earth, and that would be the process of terraforming that would allow humans to live there at all.
And the ship that you create in Aurora is an enormous vehicle. I think it's 10 kilometres long. There are two rings which are made up of the biomes sort of stitched together and big torus-shaped structures. And, I mean, you're so detailed with spokes and corridors and systems. And like, what appeals to you in creating such a detailed world like that?
Well, it's a matter of verisimilitude. If you want to have people read this novel and fall into it in the usual way of reading a novel, so that it's kind of a waking dream and you are allowed to create a world you believe in, then the more supporting detail, especially for science fiction where you're projecting a future, the better it is for the reader to build on. So I've always added a lot of detail. Some people think too much, and it's the way it is. I think it helps to create the reality effect that all novels really want to create. And in this case, there's been a lot of writing about starships, and indeed, 2001 A Space Odyssey gives you the basic model. You need some artificial source of gravity, and if you are on the inside of a spinning wheel, then you're pressed down into the outside of the wheel by a sort of analog of gravity, and that will allow you to stay healthy. So the spinning wheel that you see in 2001 A Space Odyssey, if you make two of them with an axle connecting them that is sort of aimed towards Tau Ceti, then you get the shape of my starship.
All right. Well, you mentioned 2001 A Space Odyssey, and I thought of that a couple of times as I was reading Aurora, because one of the interesting narrative devices that you use in the novel is that it's told in large part from the perspective of an artificial intelligence. Now, it's not the homicidal AI of 2001 at all, but I wonder, how did you go about conceptualizing the artificial intelligence of Aurora, and why did you want to have so much of the story told by it?
Well, it came to me in a dream. When I was working on the novel, I had a dream in which the ship's computer, the artificial intelligence, has to be quite advanced to do everything that is necessary of it to keep the ship going in the right direction and keep its living passengers alive. it said to me, I need to narrate this story. I can tell it better than anyone else. It was almost an omniscient point of view. And it made me laugh, and it gave me a project, because then a computer, a quantum computer, very quick, but programmed as a set of algorithms, would then have to figure out how to write a novel, which became for me a comic project.
Well, it is. It's a very funny chapter where you've got one of your hero characters, Devi, who's maybe the greatest of the people on the Generation Starship, trying to teach this computer how to tell a story.
Exactly. And it isn't obvious. There is no algorithm for writing a novel, of compacting a narrative out of millions of data bits. And, you know, the truth is there aren't algorithms for almost anything humans do. We are not algorithmic, and that's part of the glory of being human. For this quantum computer, the question becomes, can it figure out from what people say about novels, and by reading a bunch of novels or scanning them, can it figure out what needs to be said? And this is an iterative process where it starts out pretty clumsy, and I had a lot of fun with that because it still needed to get the story across without causing the reader to just throw the book across the room and quit. And so I had to keep that passage fairly short, but it also allowed me to say all kinds of things that an ordinary human narrator might never really talk about. So I got in my usual expository lumps in comic form this time around. And I must say, I think the AI gets a whole lot better. I mean, by the end of its part of the story, without too many spoilers, it's kind of the only character awake and goes on to a long stream of consciousness monologue, which comes out of high modernism. So I got to sort of start with 18th century novel style like Daniel Defoe and end up in a more Virginia Woolf style stream of consciousness that the computer has to go through all that.
A computer as imagined by Virginia Woolf. Fascinating.
Exactly.
And you do have a lot of fun with it because, I mean, the computer seems to care about what the reader might think. It enjoys things like metaphors and playing with alliteration. How far off do you think we are in reality of having a storytelling machine that could do that?
I don't know. I in the past, I would have been completely skeptical that we were anywhere near close enough, because we don't know how the human brain works, and our programming of computers is nothing like how the brain works, and algorithms, as I say, are not necessarily creative. But what changed my mind is talking to people who are working on quantum computers. And by exploiting quantum mechanics, if we can stabilize those systems, which is a big if, and it remains in the realm of science fiction, but they're trying, and if you can stabilize the qubits that would be the basis of a quantum computer, then you at least get extraordinarily fast machines, like way faster than the fast computers we already have. And at that point, maybe things would begin to happen. So I'm thinking in the next century or so, if we get quantum computing at all, it's going to get really strange and interesting.
On Books and Arts, we're getting strange and interesting with Kim Stanley Robinson, who's the author of the novel Aurora. And one of the main characters is Badim, and at one point he says, life is a planetary expression. And it seems to me this is the central problem in the novel. So what are you getting at there?
Well, the idea that humanity is destined to go to the stars is a kind of 19th century idea, you know, unless it's more ancient than that. But I'm thinking now that what we've learned since then about life is that that is a wrong idea, that all life is evolved on a planet and is confined to its and specified to its gravity, its magnetic field, its particular kind of sunlight, and to all the rest of the life on the planet. So we're like jellyfish in an ocean of all the rest of the life on this planet, and it all flows in and out of us, and we are not discrete. 80% of the DNA inside our bodies is not human DNA. We're a community of life forms, and boy, you need the bacteria inside you to be in agreement with the rest of you for you to feel good, as we all know, because sometimes it gets out of whack and then you're sick as a dog. So what I think is important to say is that the idea of the starship and humanity going to the stars is a kind of a old and you might even say a religious idea. It doesn't conform to the facts of the matter, and it doesn't take account of new findings and just the sheer size of the universe. And science fiction has been very poor at conveying that sense of spaciousness, that distance. Sheer distance is astonishingly beyond our imagination. But if you work at it a little, you can come to the conclusion, we really aren't meant to go to the stars. We can't do it. And that returns our attention to Earth and to our life here, our ability of the civilization that we have to get in order with the biosphere and not destroy it, not wreck ourselves. There is a project, and it's really kind of Starship Earth, and there is no Planet B. And so that's really what I wanted to say in this book in the form of a hopefully entertaining and, you know, at the end, despite all I'm saying, even a little bit hopeful ending.
Well, Kim Stanley Robinson, you're very skeptical about starship travel, as you've just explained. What do you think is the future of exploration beyond Earth, and is there any?
I love space science and space travel, and I consider our solar system to be miraculous, useful, interesting, and beautiful. And I think that we could confine our attention to the solar system and say that we've got a really fine neighborhood that we ought to explore. And the analogy I think that is best to think of is Antarctica. It takes high tech to get to Antarctica, and it's not something people think about every day, but the scientists down there, they swap in and out. They don't live their whole lives. And I think that's what space will be like for us, that Mars, the asteroids, the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, these places are interesting and actually worthy of study because Earth, too, is a planet in this system. And the more we know about the other planets, the better we're going to be at planetary management. So when I say the starships won't work, I'm not saying that space itself is a futile project. I quite love it. I think we should do more. And everything that we do in space science is a kind of an Earth science. So this is an important thing to say. And I guess through the course of my career, I've been trying to lay out a view of the situation.
But what more immediately is the next step for you?
Well, I have tried to write about the next couple centuries on Earth a few times before, and it's very hard. And I'm going to try it again because sea level rise is extremely likely to happen. And it could be that it will happen slowly enough that we don't think about it much now. But in fact, the West Antarctic Ice Sheet and Greenland are two really large ice masses that are unstable. And every time we make a prediction of how long it'll take for them to detach, the prediction like halves in time. So I'm doing a Drowned Manhattan novel, and it would be a Drowned Melbourne novel too, because yes. I'm postulating like a 50-foot sea level rise, so maybe like a 13-meter sea level rise.
Well, there go all our coastal cities, basically.
Exactly. Mm. But you know what? At that point, humanity is not going to just sit down on the high ground and weep. They're going to be getting into intertidal real estate and underwater real estate. People are resourceful, and some of these cities are extremely well built. Manhattan skyscrapers are all tucked right down into the bedrock. So I'm thinking of Manhattan as a kind of super Venice, and I'm writing about it as a kind of comedy to, you know, recover from the dark scenario of Aurora.
Kim Stanley Robinson, thank you for speaking to us on Books and Arts.
My pleasure, Matthew. Thanks for having me.
Kim Stanley Robinson's Aurora is published by Orbit, and he was speaking there on Skype to Matthew Crawford. I'm Michael Cathcart on Books and Arts. On RN. This is Books and Arts. We're on air, we're on podcast, and we're on your ABC radio app.